A long time ago, in respects to this podcast, I made some observations into the character and nature of the City of London, based on events at the time. It was way, way back in chapters 11 and 12 of this podcast, when I was talking about events some centuries ago, that I pointed out something. At the time, the first savage waves of Viking raiders were rampaging across the North Sea and the English Channel. A bevy of places, vibrant ports, thriving communities were to die off in that era, raided and pillaged, and their populations taken. Whole cities, like the massive port on the French Channel coast of Quintovich, did not survive that era. But London, in the form of Londonwick, did. Despite not having proper walls, despite the state they'd been part of for two centuries, Mercia being torn apart not just by Vikings but by their neighbours of Wessex, despite it being reduced and ruined, the residents of that Saxon wick endured. They persisted. They defied the world as it was. For me, honestly, this was the first sign of that absolute steel endurance that London has at its core. Marrow deep. It's part of the answer to the question, what makes London, London? That stubbornness. Later, around chapters 53 and 54 of the story, when I was describing events in the 11th century and the carnage of the aftermath of the Norman conquest, I described those few years where London was hit by a seemingly endless wave of calamity. War, famine, epidemics, fire, tornadoes and more all slammed into this community. And again, I mentioned then how despite all of this, London endured. London persisted. London got back on with it. And here we are, the 1350s, and London is about to show that trait again, because with all that was going on, the last thing the city needed was the Black Death to suddenly return. But it did. A new outbreak, what historical records of the time called Secunda Mortalitas, the Second Mortality. And it was just as brutal as the first. Indeed, in some respects, it was possibly worse. Because this time, this outbreak, the disease seemed to target the young especially. The plague went after London's children with an especial ferocity, causing haunting and bitter tears and killing thousands. And yet, still, as we know, London endured. Hi there, my name is Saul, and this is the story of London. This podcast tries to tell the chronological history of the city in the style of a grand narrative story. And this week, we cover four very intense years. It's the story of the city getting on with life, the story of the geopolitical fallout of the great victories of the king, and it's a tale of the much overlooked second outbreak of the Black Death. And it's a story about London itself. While time has passed and years have flown, I cannot help but look at those residents back then with utter admiration. London was suffering and yet they endured. My only hope is that I can honour our city's illustrious forebears by doing their story justice. Welcome then to chapter 126 of The Story of London. Secunda Mortalitas. We left London celebrating one hell of a party. The rejoicing of the news to the victory of the Battle of Poitiers. The zenith of glory of Edward, the Black Prince, Prince of Wales and hero to his people. The grand celebrations that we saw London partaking in at the end of the last chapter were glorious and lasted for quite some time. Of course, as always, when there was a celebration, either before or just after, London also realised just how bad the condition of the streets were. Like a broken recording, it was time again for the authorities of London to confront the fact that the streets of the City of London were filthy, dirty, and mostly messy. The city fathers complained of lanes filled with dung, broken boxes, empty tons of wine, and other articles, quote, lying in place in the streets and lanes before the doors of diverse folks, unquote. It was ordered that no man should carry, quote, any manner of rubbish, earth, gravel, or dung, from out of his stable or elsewhere to throw and put the same into the rivers of the Thames and the Fleet, or into the wells around the walls of the city. And as to the dung that is found in the streets and lanes, the same shall be carried and taken elsewhere out of the city by carts, or else by the rakers to certain spots, that the same may be put into dung boats without throwing anything into the Thames, unquote. Yeah, could you please start putting your shit in the water supply? Thanks. As always, the conditions in the city were clearly smelly, messy and crowded. And by 1359, the desire to clean up the streets took a darker turn, as we read in the city ordinances that year, quote, for so much as many men and women, and others of diverse counties, who might work to the help of the common people, have betaken themselves out of their county to the city of London, and do go about begging there, so as to have their own ease and repose, not wishing to labour or work for their substance, to the great damage of the common people, and also do waste alms, which would be otherwise given to many poor folks, such as lepers, blind, halt, and persons oppressed with old age, and divers other maladies. We do therefore command, on behalf of the Lord the King, that all those who go about begging in said city, and who are able to labour and work, shall quit the said city between now and the Monday next ensuing, unquote. Yeah, there seems to have been a clampdown on the 14th century version of NEETs, people not in education, employment or training. The able-bodied beggars of London, according to the authorities, did so to carry on their own ease and repose, and they'd been given a week to get the hell out of London and move beyond the walls of the city, or else. What was the all else, by the way? Well, the proclamation goes on to say, quote, if any such shall be found begging after the day aforesaid, the same shall be taken and put in the stocks on Cornhill for half a day the first time, and the second time he shall remain in the stocks a whole day, and the third time he shall be taken and shall remain in prison for 40 days, and then shall forswear the said city forever, unquote. Of course, as London returned back to normal after the wild celebrations, it got back to its normal passions. And as we've said, this city was a place of barely contained anger, not just at growing numbers of beggars and vagrants, and certainly not just at the amount of shit in the streets. The established professions were under attack from foreigners. And in 1359, we saw and heard an example of how bad the anger towards foreigners was. That October, Mayor John Lovkin led an investigation into a group of criminals who, quote, maliciously did perpetuate a certain dreadful array in an attack made by certain mercers of the city upon some merchants of Lombardy, unquote. Yep, the mercers of London, who, as explained a few chapters ago, were losing a lot of trade to Italian importers of fine cloth, were clearly deciding to take matters into their own hand. This group of mercers, quote, with force of arms did beat, wound, and dreadfully maltreat one Francisco Butchell and other Lombards in the said city, unquote. The investigations into this attack revealed, quote, Henry Forrester, mercer, Thomas de Meldon, mercer, and John Mailwood, mercer, made a certain dreadful affray in the Old Jewry in the ward of Coleman Street in London, and of malice aforethought by force and arms did make assault on certain persons, namely Francesco Bocci and Raymond Flammy, Lombards, and did wound, beat, and maltreat them, and commit other enormities against them. They say also that Richard Philip, mercer, abetted the same persons in making the affray and trespasses aforesaid, and that the aforesaid Richard Philip was present when the deeds aforesaid were committed, and that the same Richard did strike Francesco and Raymond aforesaid, unquote. While it does not go on to say it in the text, given the title for this entry in London's records refer to a murderous attack in Old Jewry, we must assume that one of these Italians was killed. It was one of the more high-profile crimes of the year and denotes the smouldering resentment towards the Italians felt by the mercers of the city. And I must remind folks, that resentment towards Italians was being held by a large majority of other Londoners. But it was not the only high-profile crime in London that year. The other was a theft where, quote, vestments, books and other muniments belonging to the prior and brethren of the Order of the Holy Cross of London, unquote, took place. Someone robbed the Order of Crutched Friars. It was substantial enough that the king himself ordered the city to investigate the robbery. And they concluded that, quote, Brother Robert Stanno, Brother John Dunmo and Brother Richard de Evesham, belonging to the Order of the House of the Church of the Holy Cross, near the Tower of London, unquote, were the three principal thieves. And they allegedly stole, quote, one chalice, two sets of vestments, four portfolios, two psalters, one book called The Legend of the Saints, one epistola, one set of institutes, the common seal of the house aforesaid, 15 bulls apostolic concerning the order and the prior and the convent of the church aforesaid, and many other remembrances and muniments touching upon said order. And also other goods and chattels, namely linen and woolen cloths, to the value of £87, 13 shillings and 4 pence, unquote. By 1360, however, crime stops being the primary issue of the new mayor, John Rothe. He has to deal with, well, complaints. And the main ones was about, quote, diverse nuisances in the ward of Farndon without the city, unquote. 12 residents of that region had come to the mayor and complaining that things were, well, slipping. Their complaint said that, quote, that time out of mind, the commonalty of the city had been wont to have free ingress and egress with horses and carts from sunrise to sunset for the carrying and the carting of all manner of victuals and wares, therefore, to the water of the Thames, and from said water of the Thames to the city aforesaid, through the great gate of the Templars, situate within Temple Bar, in the suburb of London. And that the possessors of the temple were wont, and by right ought, to maintain a bridge at the water aforesaid, and a common latrine there, well covered with four operates therein over the same water. And that the possessors of these structures in Fleet Street, in the suburb of London, ought to pave the road on either side of that structure, unquote. So yeah, what they were complaining about is that their previous landlords, the Knights Templar, for all their many sins, had been quite generous to the area. They maintained a bridge or a jetty. They allowed people to access the River Thames via the temple structure. And they also included and had built a four-booth public toilet over the river with well-paved roads. That's quite nice. So what were the residents complaining about? Well, quote, the prior of St. John of Jerusalem in England, who is possessor of the temple, molests the citizens of said city, so they cannot have their free ingress and egress through the gate aforesaid, as of old they were wont to have. And the said prior does not maintain the said latrine, as he ought to do, and that by default of the said prior, who is possessor of the structure aforesaid, the pavement pertaining to said structure is worn out and broken, and dangerous to all persons passing or riding by. Unquote. Oh, those bloody Knights Hospitallers. Yep, it turns out that the locals liked their public privy, and the Knights of the Order of St. John, who'd been granted possession of the temple, were not maintaining the place. What was that? Rich landlords not spending to maintain the properties they owned to the detriment of the locals of London? Who could ever believe such a thing could ever happen in this city, eh? Yeah. We can only assume, by the way, that they did repair the privy and that the Knights Hospitallers did allow people to access the river via Temple Bar. But we're not too sure. 1361 was also the year that the royal wardrobe moved again. Back in 1328, it moved to an old house on Lombard Street, but just under 40 years later, here it is, relocating, with the royal estate purchasing the mansion of St. John Beauchamp on the south side of Carter Lane. This house was on the corner of today's Blackfriars Lane, a street which runs along the course of a tidal inlet from the Thames, and it was a massive project. The royal wardrobe now stepped up a gear. It moved from being a place where the king and the royal court stored its clothing and housing items to now also include manufacturing capabilities. within the wardrobe, there was space enough to manufacture many of the items that would be used in the royal court, and also space to house the official keeper of the wardrobe and all his staff. It was set up to capitalise upon the growth of foreign imports of high-quality goods into London, and the facilities included workrooms, a great hall, separate royal halls, a chapel, a treasury, a kitchen, and numerous other chambers. Over the next 300 years, the royal wardrobe would grow to become a massive employer within the City of London. They gave jobs to over 800 people, some of whom lived in the Great Wardrobe's precinct, embroidering, weaving, spinning, and lace making. Meanwhile, while all this was going on in London, the regime of King Edward was hoping to capitalize upon their recent victories in France. I mean, the King of France had just been captured and was now a prisoner of England. The war was over, right? Edward could now claim to be King of France. That's why he was fighting. Right? Ah, if only things were as simple as that. What follows then is a brief look at the King's foreign policy for the next few years, and it's important for the story of London for many reasons. Several places now coming under English domination, including and above all Calais, were to have a significant impact upon the fortunes of London going forward, and as such, we do need to divert away from our city just for a little to look at the bigger picture. Before describing how Edward III was going to win this war with France, we've got to work out what his definition of a win would have been. Now, Edward was probably not seeking to re-establish the old Plantagenet Angevin empire of Henry II. I mean, if you look at the actual things he did, you can see that where he invaded was mostly actually dictated by ease of access, as opposed to my ancestors used to rule this. On top of this, Edward's campaigns were not restricted to the old Angevin lands. Gascony didn't need to be restored to him, as it was already his as the King of England. In fact, the military service of the Gascons formed an important contribution to all those glorious expeditions of the Duke of Lancaster and the Black Prince. All major campaigns fought by Edward were actually fought in land ruled by King Philip and King John of France. Now, the English style of campaign, the chevauchée, where, you know, you just grab a bunch of mates together and ride off a raiding and a pillaging, can be seen as an entirely appropriate tactic to be used by a claimant of the throne. It aimed at demonstrating Edward's might in as wide an area as possible, thereby undermining Philip and John's authority and challenging their right to rule. He was certainly using his claim to the French throne to push his war, but it's also worth noting that it's fairly obvious that the king knew he wasn't actually going to rule France as his king. According to one historian, whose conclusion I do agree with, well, as they put it, Edward III was an opportunist. Quote, he would take whatever came his way, as much as he'd done before 1340 in his dealings with the Scots, the Emperor and the Flemish. If military success and French noble defections had enabled him to depose Philip or John, he would have surely done so. Unquote. This historian goes on to say, quote, Edward did not know in 1340 whether he would be able to conquer France. It seems, however, that he did not hesitate to make war there, and his successes mounted, so the desire to make war became self-reinforcing. For Edward and his people, the waging of war against France became an end unto itself, unquote. So, if his war was going on because he was winning and it gave him reason to keep winning, what was the end scenario? I mean, this war carried on for years. And because of his claim upon the French throne, well, it gave him an endless justification to keep fighting, but it also wrecked any chance of peace. I mean, the peace negotiations in 1344, 1352 to 54, and 1358 to 59, they all failed because Edward refused to drop his claim to the throne. Yet again, though, it is clear that he knew that he could never conquer France. Additional proof, with the exception of Brittany and Calais, Edward III didn't conquer territory. He and his captains led raid into French lands and sacked French towns, but they did not leave behind any occupying armies. This failure by Edward III to install garrisons may well be explained simply by a lack of resources. I mean, we know the defence of Calais was a major drain on English revenues. But it may also suggest that Edward's plans was to harass the French into a settlement rather than conquer France. And it has to be said that the strength of French resistance to him was pretty formidable. Even after his great victories at Crecy and Poitiers, the French were still rallying behind their Valois rulers. It remains difficult to assess just how seriously King Edward took his claim to the throne of France. He certainly invested a considerable amount of time, men and money into his campaigns, but his actions suggest that he was not so much a man of principle, more pure opportunity, but ultimately a realist. He knew he could not conquer France, but he could dismember it. And this may have been his plan all along, as some historians have suggested. At the peace negotiations at Guyens in April 1354, King John II, the French king, was more willing to negotiate than his father had ever been, and he worried that the English and the Navarrese could ally, and he seemed prepared to offer Aquitaine, Pouton, Normandy, Anjou, Maine, Poitou, and Calais to the king in return for him giving up the claim on the throne of France. It has been usually assumed that it was the English who prevented the settlement being ratified, but at least one historian has suggested it was rather the French who changed their minds. But the principle of the dismember of France remained central to Edward's diplomatic negotiations after this. The First and Second Treaties of London in May 58 and March 59 also envisaged a breakup of France. So this was what he seemed to be after. By the late 1350s, however, Edward was now forced to deal with a dilemma. You see, John II had been captured by the Black Prince at the Battle of Poitiers, which we covered last chapter. Now, although this strengthened Edward's negotiating position in some ways, it also really complicated it in other ways. See, the capture of King John gave Edward the salivating prospect of a massive ransom, and one was asked for, 4 million écus. The problem was, to justify charging that much cash, Edward had to accept that John was the king and thus was worth 4 million écus. Edward now knew that his main thing was to recognize John as king and to get John to make substantial territorial concessions. But he also clearly intended to pursue to the utmost the opportunity that John's capture provided, and he thus still hoped to exploit French weaknesses to the limit. And as March 1349 show, he may have deliberately set these terms and conditions so high that the government in Paris of the Dauphin Charles would reject them. And this refusal gave Edward the cause to invade again in October 1359. And now he made for Reims, carrying, apparently, a spare crown with him because he could present himself as King of the French. And if that didn't work, the campaign would put further pressure on the French to accept his terms for a territorial settlement that was effectively dismembering Valois France. Now, to do this campaign, Edward raised an army of 12,000 men in England, the second largest army ever assembled during this period. Yes, it was dwarfed by the 32,000 deployed at the Siege of Calais, but it was still a huge number. And it was so large that the English were not to see such a force in France until 1475. But ultimately, this plan misfired. He attacked over a particularly harsh winter. His wasn't able to consolidate on it, and his failure actually weakened rather than strengthened his position. So by 1360, he knew he had to give up his French title. The crown had not been gained, but what he did gain was dismembering France. Here, however, that last relative failure of his campaign forced him to reduce the demands he put forward to it. The opportunist had not succeeded. The realist saw that he had to accept what he could get. He could scarcely raise another army in the scale of that 1359 campaign. And so the Treaty of Calais of October 1360 was signed, and this gave Edward Aquitaine, Poitou, Poitiers, Guines, and Calais and the region around it. And King John was to be ransomed for 3 million écus. In return, Edward was going to renounce his claim to the French throne and to rulership of Normandy, Anjou, and Maine. There was a slight complication. At the time of the signing of the Treaty of Calais, not all of the promised territories were in Edward's hands. In order to guarantee that the French would hand them over, Edward seems to have separate from the main body of the Treaty of Calais the clauses concerning renunciations. His own renunciation of the French throne and the French renunciation of sovereignty over the extended land holdings that just given to the English. Thus, his giving up of the French title became dependent on his receipt of the territories. And this led to a complicated series of you say you give this up and I will give this up type arrangements, all leading to the moment where Edward finally says, okay, I'm not actually King of France. And this caused its own set of confusion and was one of the reasons eventually this peace settlement wasn't to hold. It seems unlikely, however, that Edward had deliberately added this clause to give him a loophole. He did it to ensure the territories promised would come into his hand. And by the time the clause was separated from the main body of the treaty, Edward had already committed himself to surrendering his title. By agreeing to ransom John and by coming to a treaty with him, he was recognising John was the rightful king. From October 1360, Edward stopped using the French title, even though the transfers of land had not been completed. Admittedly, yes, Edward never formally renounced his French title, but John's kingship was never subsequently denied by Edward, even after the war started again in 1369. And actually, Edward did surrender to the French the few fortifications he held in Normandy, Anjou, and Maine over the course of 1360-61. We can therefore suggest that Edward had intended the treaty at Calais to be an end, and that John II did too, for he never denied his ransom obligations. Both sides saw this settlement as a full negotiated peace treaty, the first since 1327. It was intended to mark the end of both Edward's claim to the throne and of French sovereignty in his continental possessions. Edward's principal concern from 1360 onward was the exercise of full sovereignty over his lands in France, and it continued to be his main concern going into the decade. In Edward's eyes, the Treaty of 1360 was a victory, although most historians, but not all of them, have seen it as a climb down. I'm with the ones who see it, actually, that it was a bit of a victory. Through a combination of a useful, if unfulfillable, claim to the French throne and considerable military success over 20 years, Edward III had forced the French to accept his terms, thus winning for himself direct rule over a sizable portion of France. He might have surrendered the title of King of France, but he gained huge territories he could hold as King of England. He had broken France. Edward III had achieved more than any of his predecessors could ever have imagined. The land under his sovereign control was of a greater extent than any English king had enjoyed since 1204. And this whole series of wars and the dismemberment of the French royal territory actually gave him and his people an unprecedented military reputation across Europe. And it also sharpened national identity, a culmination of a process largely originating under his grandfather, Edward I. This is clearly revealed in the Parliament of 1363, where the Commons thanking Edward for delivering them from, quote, servitude to other lands and from the charges sustained by them in times past, unquote. Edward Starr was in full ascendancy at home and abroad. And over the 1360s, he sought to maintain this position and to damage French interests further by throwing his weight all over Europe. His own intervention in Flemish affairs was matched by his son's involvement in Spain. In both areas, however, they failed in their objectives. And Charles V, the next king, was less willing to adhere to the treaties than his father was, and he was able to outwit them and restore French fortunes, and that's all in the future. But for now, with that glorious treaty of 1360, London could be forgiven to thinking, hey, the war is finally over, and that means the drain on the economy is over, and that means there's opportunity. A chance to reclaim lost fortunes. A chance to rebuild. 1361 promised hope. And yet it dragged the city into the depths of hell. We know from the records of monks in the priory in Lynn that, quote, after the next Easter following, men and women died in great multitudes. In that year, the plague raged in the southern parts of England with great mortality amongst children, youths, and the wealthy. The plague was, however, much less serious than that which had befallen 13 years before, unquote. The plague was back. The Black Death returned. But this version seemed to be different. It was striking at the young and amidst adults disproportionately killing men over women. One account claimed that this outbreak actually started on the filthy streets of London itself, and they called it, quote, a great pestilence of men, killing many men but few women, unquote. And this is confirmed by other records across the country, and even one Irish abbey describing it as, quote, a mortality of men, especially of boys, unquote. The anonymous Canterbury Chronicle provides with some description of the outward symptoms of this disease. Quote, children and adolescents were generally the first to die, and then the elderly. Members of religious orders and parish clergy and others died suddenly without respect of persons when the first spots and the other signs of death appeared on their bodies, as on the bodies of the victims everywhere. Many churches were left unserved and empty through lack of priests. The plague lasted for more than 4 months in England, unquote. In contrast to that first epidemic, the course of the 1361 plague across England and indeed Europe has yet to be clearly established. And certainly there seem to be few warning references in any correspondence at the time, so it may well be that this outbreak originated in England, and possibly in London, as several records maintain. And thus death did not just stalk the streets of London. Perhaps this great death was born on those fetid and crowded streets we mentioned earlier. The earliest victim in London, we think, is one Agnes, the unmarried daughter of the cordwainer Richard Sorrell, living in the parish of St. Michael le Quern, and her will dated April 22nd. Another early victim may have been Margaret Candon, an orphan and minor whose death on April 25th was reported by her guardian. During the first few weeks of the outbreak, we see a small surge in wills and so forth being made by rich people. One of these was for Alan de Scaronage, a clerk at Holy Trinity Priory, Aldgate, who lived through the first plague and who left 10 shillings for his daughter's wedding to be arranged by the prior for whom he had worked. Soon after this, the king also issued orders strongly reminiscent of those he'd made in the first outbreak, closing the ports on April the 30th to everybody except merchants. As the plague began to take hold, it started piling up the dead, and we see in documents of the time specific references to further burials in the Smithfield Cemetery taking place during the second outbreak. The emergency plague cemetery was being pressed into service once more. Despite the plague, or maybe because of it, work on royal projects was not set aside despite the worsening situation. The king appointed two men with funds sufficient for workmen to accommodate themselves in the tower and to convey materials therein. Thomas Chamberlain likewise was charged with delivery of stone, timber, lime, tiles and other necessities for the king's work in Westminster Palace and the Tower of London, and carriage for the same to be paid by the hands of the king's surveyor. King Edward appears to have shown some urgency in matters, completing one particular of the royal religious projects amongst the several he was doing at the time, perhaps for good reason. The Church of St. Mary Grace's, founded on the site of the Holy Trinity Plague Cemetery near the tower, remained mostly incomplete, and the king, as such, appointed a man called John Corey, a clerk who had consolidated the land for the cemetery in 1349, and also a master mason, quote, to take 24 carpenters, masons, tilers, and other workmen, unquote, to work on that church, also providing royal protection for the workmen, wishing, quote, to hasten the works as much as possible, unquote. Yeah, let's build a church on the plague cemetery fast. Royal concern with the sanitation, the link between refuse disposal and the plague, did come up. I've just described how bad it was in London. Well, in May that year, Edward ordered the removal of the slaughterhouses from the city to Stratford and to Knightsbridge. And he complained to the mayor and commonalty of London that, quote, by the killing of great beasts, from whose putrid blood running down the streets and the bowels cast into the Thames, the air in the city is very much corrupted and infected, whence abominable and most filthy stench proceeds. Sickness and many other evils have happened to such as have abode in the said city, or have resorted to it, and great dangers are feared to fall out from time to come, unless remedy be presently made against it." Unquote. So yeah, the prevailing belief was that the plague was caused by stenches and bad air, and nothing so created bad air as the butchering and slaughtering of animals on the streets of London. So, get it out of the city, so saith the king. I just like the idea that at one point in our history, Knightsbridge was famed for the stench of it, and for the rivers of blood within it, and for the offal in it, as it became one of the designated slaughter places of the city. The wills of London's richer residents continued to provide evidence both of the speed of death and the impact the plague had on whole families. Robert de Galford, a draper, made his will on the 12th of May, making provisions for his four children. He died within 2 weeks, and his wife Joanna's will, made on the 27th of May, specified her burial place by his side in the Lady Chapel of St. Augustine Papery. By this time, two of their children had also perished, leaving Rosaria, aged 11, and Henry, aged 9. When the mother died, the two remaining children were placed with different guardians. Nicholas Horwood, from the parish of St. Nicholas Olive, died within 2 weeks of his will, dated on the 16th of May. In the will, he left bequests to his children, but by 7th of June, the date of his wife Johanna's will, only one son survived. The crisis was again participating confusion amongst the citizens, and it's best summed up by looking at the family of one high-profile victim, Richard de Wickham. He was a wealthy corder, married with three daughters, one of whom was a nun over in Barking Abbey. His will, written on the 10th of May, made his wife guardian of his youngest daughter, Isabella, and provided for the latter 200 marks of silver for her future marriage and his best silver spice dish. However, by the 4th of July, it was necessary for the mayor and the chamberlain to order the sergeant of the Guildhall to take Isabella, now an orphan, into the city's hands and to summon the executors of de Wickham's will. The sergeant reported on the same day that the little girl, said by the executors to be about 9 years old, had been, quote, carried away, unquote, and could not be found. The executors, meanwhile, brought the bowl and the dish to be placed in safekeeping for the girl's return. The hope for Isabella's return was obviously held on for years, but it was ultimately in vain. 7 years later, her cousin came to the court to claim the legacy, confirming the young girl had indeed died in 1361. Thus, the plague had probably killed the father, the mother, and at least one daughter. The horror of the outbreak soon began to impact upon the royal administration. On the 10th of May, the king was compelled to write to Robert de Thorpe, the chief justice, that, quote, "Whereas great multitudes of people are suddenly smitten by the Dudley plague, now prevailing both in the city of London and its neighbouring parts, and the plague is daily increasing, whereby many presenting pleas and business in the king's court have, for fear of death, drawn to their own parts, leaving such pleas and business in peril of loss. Wherefore, by assent of the nobles and others of the council, the king has appointed that all pleas pending to the bench shall be continued in the state they are now until the morrow of the midsummer," unquote. Once again, the royal courts of justice were suspended in the face of plague. Like last time, key personnel in the cathedral and monastic houses again began to fall victim. On the same day as the common bench was suspended, the will of William de Ravenstone, the almoner of St. Paul's Cathedral, effectively also its schoolmaster, was written down. Ravenstone's will is interesting in two counts. First, attached to it was a list of books of learning he bequeathed to the boys, and second, it actually provides clear details of the furnishings and arrangements of the almonry school. The prior of St. Bart's up in Smithfield, John de Callerton, succumbed in early May. On the 15th of May, the king committed to the sub-prior and convent the guardianship of the house and all temporarilies, quote, "for as long as it is void following the death of John, the last prior," unquote. Across the river in Southwark, things were no better, and it's probable that the plague carried off John de Braidway, the master of the Hospital of St. Thomas, before the 13th of May, when a new master, a former canon from the Priory of St. Mary Overy, called Richard de Stokes, was elected. But he too died before December, leading to the appointment of his successor falling to Richard Edlington as bishop because all the brethren bar one had died in the plague. Secular clergy were no more immune than had been in the first outbreak, and we read that John de Thornton, the chaplain of the Church of St. Dunstan in the West, and Robert de Elkiller, chaplain to the Church of St. Stephen Walbrook, also died during that May and June. By June, the wills of rich citizens reached a peak at 33, with a quarter of these dating to 3 days of the 12th to the 14th of June. The plague continued to strike rapidly. William Darby, a tailor, made his will on the 5th of June and was dead and buried at the foot of his father's tomb in the Church of St. Mary Aldermany by the 12th, when his wife, Agnes, made her will to be buried at his side under a marble slab. Thomas de Walden, former chaplain of the Guildhall and principal apothecary of Westminster Abbey since at least 1340, fell to the plague in this time too. Looking at the scattered records we have of this outbreak, there is one theme that comes up again and again, and it's heartbreaking. The cluster of wills of fathers wishing to be buried alongside their recently dead children. Hugh de Pater was the most famous of these. It was the same Hugh who had been appointed master painter of the chapel of St. Stephen Westminster back in March 1350. And he was destined to survive this outbreak. He nevertheless updated his will in June 1361, stating his desire to be buried next to his child in the churchyard of St. Giles Cripplegate. But around this example were others. William Wyle, on the 20th of June, chose his burial plot adjacent to the tomb of Alice's daughter in the Church of St. Sepulchre, Newgate. Robert Fournor, a fishmonger, willed burial next to his children in the Church of St. Leonard Eastcheap. And Walter de Shendangington wished burial next to his children in the churchyard of St. Dunstan in the West. The appearance of such cases 2 months into the plague may indicate that children were amongst the earlier victims of the outbreak, and may explain why it was considered to have been so virulent amongst the young. It has to be said that the archaeological evidence for the plague's impact on children is less clear-cut than the chronicle reports that it targeted children especially. It seems like this outbreak hit the young first, but then number of adults actually caught up with it. But the requests of all these fathers does tell us that grief was something felt just as keenly by parents then as it is now. And the trauma of this even threatening children would have impacted parents and coloured the thoughts of anybody living at the time about the outbreak. I mean, just the hint that this disease was going after the young more than the old would make that the one takeaway feature every parent would share. In the wills that followed, we see something else. If the first plague acted as a catalyst for bequests to be given to the local craft-based religious groups, the Fraternity of London, then the second outbreak confirmed their importance in the eyes of London's wealthier and working citizens. The plague evidently then breached the walls of the Tower of London in June, and the king gave license for two of his noble French hostages, one no less than the son of the French king, Louis the Duke of Anjou, to leave London and go to any place within the realm for 1 month, on condition at the end of the month they return to present themselves to the king and his council, as they were hostages, and they'd take their word if they would. John of Bicca, the king's master of artillery in the Tower, made his will on the 19th of June and was dead before the 1st of July. Adam de Turry, the king's smith in the Tower, also perished about the same time. A third officer of the Tower may have also succumbed. On the 30th of August, the king issued an arrest warrant for two men who had taken the assets of William de Rothwell, the keeper of the king's wardrobe in the Tower. The latter, in debt to the king, was described as having, quote, departed this life and not yet rendered account of such jewels and things, unquote. And this plague was still passing through the Tower in September, when Sir Thomas of Morey, a Scottish hostage kept there since 1357 to ensure the repayment of David II of Scotland's ransom, had not been given leave of absence, and he contracted the plague and died sometime before Michaelmas. Outside of the tower, another of the king's London servants, John Melwane, who collected the duties paid for the official weighing of merchandise of wool imports and exports through London, made his will on the 10th of June and died on the 28th. He was buried near his wife in the Church of Holy Trinity Priory, Aldgate, and the king passed the office to the fishmonger mayor of London that year. Melwane may have died on what Italian merchants reported was the peak of the outbreak. The Florentine chronicler Matteo Villani recorded that the plague had broken out in London in April and that its peak was on the 24th of June, where 1,200 people perished on a single day. July brought no relief from the misery. The national scale of the epidemic is confirmed by the issuing of a letter by the Archbishop of York, dated on the 12th of that month. Its contents and recommendations for prayer were very similar to instructions issued in 1348, and these surely spread to Londoners with haste. Quote, "The kingdom of England is assailed with pestilence and other misfortune, directed at driving away the sins of men on such a scale and after such a long time. Therefore, we believe it is important to urge more devoutly and insistently suffrages of devout prayer and other offices of pious propitiation," unquote. Simply put, it does seem to be that the advice they gave to the citizens on how to survive the plague was to resort to prayer. Obviously, this didn't stop it. In the city, we see records of the deaths of the widow Alice Utpenny, the daughter of William de Derby, who wished to be buried in Pardon Churchyard of St. Paul's next to her late husband. And her father, William de Derby, was buried in St. Aldermanry less than a month later. Two former mayors also prepared for the worst. Henry Pickard, the mayor in 1257 and 58, drew up his will on the 3rd of July. Yet he luckily survived the plague. Richard de Kingsbury was not so lucky, and he died in round about the middle of July. Swifter still was the passing of a merchant from Bromley, a man called Richard Lacer, who had lots of interests in London. His will was dated on the 27th of July, yet that of his wife Isabella, drawn up just 2 days later, described her as, quote, "relic of Richard, late Mercer," unquote. The plague stalked the halls of the rich people and the poor of Westminster, Southwark and London, and the streets were filled with death. Judging from the rate at which wills were being drawn up and enrolled, the death rate by high summer was comparable to that of January 1349, making this outbreak incredibly serious indeed. Despite the availability of extramural plague cemeteries, burial space once again seems to have become an issue in the city. On the 26th of July, the king gave license for the transfer by a man called Simon de Morden and his wife to a man called John de Hockden, the parson of the church of St. Martin Auger in Candlewick Street, of a plot of land 47 feet long and 33 feet broad, situated between St. Martin's Churchyard and the Church of St. Michael, quote, "for the enlargement of the said churchyard," unquote. The bodies just kept on piling up. But the virulence of the epidemic began to diminish as summer turned to autumn, and will-making dropped to single figures. After this, matters returned to normal levels. Collectively, the city was no longer in a panic about mortality. The plague appeared to have affected the clergy of St. Paul's Cathedral significantly. The king, empowered by vacancies to appoint officers and confer prebendary positions, began filling vacancies soon after. And from this we can see at least six, and as possibly as many as nine, of the former holders of prebendary positions had perished between July and October 1361, out of a grand total of 30. Other religious houses probably fared no better, but evidence is scant. December saw the appointment of a new master of the Hospital of St. Thomas in Southwark. The election devolved to the Bishop of Winchester and his treasurer, quote, "owing to the death of all the brethren save one," unquote. And the important hospital and monastery of St. John Clerkenwell, it was significant that in 1361 the number of serving clerks and chaplains was way below strength, something repeated at Westminster Abbey, where it dropped from 50 monks to about 30, and that persisted for quite some time. This outbreak lasted then from the middle of April to perhaps the end of October, a total of over 6 months, compared to the 9 months of the first outbreak of the plague. It was a major event, only eclipsed in literature and in the records by the magnitude of what had preceded it the first time round. And again, it must be said, most of our records talk of the rich and the great and the good, those whose names are recorded in the documents of history. For each of these people said, multitudes of poorer, normal people passed from this sudden, horrific outbreak. The second plague was not as drastic as the first one, but it reduced London's population. The city suffered again. And yet, as I said at the start, London endured. It carried on. It got back on with life. A new peace treaty was promising much, but the city, as it was to embrace its future, had to realise that this second mortality had further helped sever London from its past. Like falling dominoes, events were now sliding into place. And 20 years into the future from now, London was to see itself at the heart of violence and chaos that could threaten to topple the entire country. But that was coming like a hurricane. And we'll cover that in future episodes. We're going to leave it here. Thank you very much for listening. Hope you enjoyed it. The story of London will return next week. We've got some amazing episodes coming up. We're going to be doing a profile of Geoffrey Chaucer and what he was up to and why he became such a dude. John Wycliffe and why he became such a really bad dude. We have the death of Edward III. Oh, good God, 10-year-old becomes king. The peasants' revolt's coming. And just to let you know, the saga of the Jubilee is coming up. And I have been looking forward to that for quite some time. So, loads to look forward to. I hope you're all okay. This is Saul saying thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. Bye.